This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
VOA Africa, thank you for joining us. I'm Yahya Suhaib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The current variant is spreading in a very rapid rate. So for him to test positive this time might mean a lot of things for us, even stricter restrictions and the mandates that we're waiting to hear.
That's Nomazwi Dlamini, one of many South Africans worried that President Cyril Ramaphosa's positive test for COVID-19 could lead to fresh lockdown restrictions. Details coming up. Also, U.S. President Joe Biden has told participants in the two-day virtual summit that democracy should be defended and strengthened. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. President Biden says democracy does not happen by accident. People have to defend it, fight for it, strengthen it, and renew it. Since day one, Biden's administration has made clear that renewing democracy in the United States and around the world is essential to meeting the unprecedented challenges of our time. Reporter Angie Omar spoke to Sarah Leigh Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, on Biden's U.S. summit.
I think that the Democracy Summit is a real missed opportunity and is going to be a failure in terms of the priorities that President Biden has identified and reasons he's pursuing a Democracy Summit. And it's going to be a failure not just in the Middle East, but across the globe more broadly. And the principal reason for that is the United States is talking about a Democracy Summit, but the United States is promoting autocracy, dictatorship, and apartheid in the Middle East. The whole world can see that. And that's why no one is going to buy President Biden's claim that the United States wants to support and promote democracy, when in fact, we're doing the exact opposite.
Mrs. Watson, the U.S. Democracy Summit will lead to imposition of sanctions on undemocratic forces. Various U.S. media outlets reported that the U.S. Treasury Department will impose a series of sanctions targeting people engaged in practices that undermine democracy. The sanctions will also target those involved in serious human rights violations and corruption. How could that help in fighting the rising trend, especially in Africa and the Middle East, toward authoritarianism?
Well, sanctions against human rights abusers already exist. They exist in the form of Magnitsky sanctions. They exist in the form of the recently announced Khashoggi ban. I don't know if what the administration is proposing is a new set of sanctions. The United States really has an addiction to sanctions, and in fact imposes sanctions on over 30 countries around the world, many with very devastating effect on the civilian population of these countries. Individual targeted sanctions against abusers can be effective and are important, and we do advocate for them. The problem is that the United States only imposes sanctions, or almost exclusively imposes sanctions, on nationals of countries that we identify as enemies. And so you'll see plenty of sanctions against Iranians, including for unjust trials, but no sanctions against Saudis for unjust trials. In one of the most brazen, kind of laughable displays of hypocrisy, the Khashoggi ban doesn't even sanction the main culprit of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and that is Mohammed bin Salman. If the United States wants to use these sanctions to be seen as a tool and a punishment and accountability for human rights abusers, then it absolutely positively has to impose these sanctions in a consistent, even-handed way with no sweetheart deals for the dictators and tyrants that it supports.
The U.S. Freedom House Index for Democracies 2021 places 77 invitees to the U.S. Democracy Conference among free or fully democratic states. Another 31 rank as partly free, and 3, Angola, Congo, and Iraq as not free. What do you make of that?
There has been a very disturbing decline in the democratic rankings of countries around the world. The number of countries that are partly free or not free has increased. The fact is that there, in reality, is no country in the Middle East and North Africa that is free. And I think the inclusion of Israel as a democracy in the democracy summit is highly problematic. That would be like inviting South Africa under apartheid to a democracy summit because it's democratic for the white people there. That Israel may be democratic for its Jewish citizens, but not the millions and millions and millions of Palestinians who live under military occupation or who face legally sanctioned discrimination and exclusion means it's highly questionable that it's actually a democracy. The fact that there were really no democracies in the Arab world to invite, and Iraq is the one that's invited as a little bit of a consolation prize, should be something that the Arab world is deeply, deeply ashamed about, but that the United States has a responsibility for, because really, what is it doing to promote democracy in Saudi Arabia and Egypt?
That was Sarah Leigh Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, speaking with reporter Angie Omar. As mentioned earlier, U.S. President Joe Biden just held a two-day virtual summit on democracy to consider how countries can strengthen their systems to meet the challenges ahead. While dozens of countries were invited, only 15 African countries made it onto the invitation list. Earlier this week, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told VOA that an invitation does not mean a U.S. stamp of approval. She said, "Every democracy is a work in progress, and it does not mean that we are giving the opposite of a stamp of approval or a negative stamp to people who are not invited." Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam in the second part of their discussion that a number of African countries have made important gains towards democracy in recent years, including Zambia and Malawi, and there's been record levels of protests as African citizens demand higher standards and more democracy.
The demand for democracy remains highly resilient. You know, more than 70% of Africans aspire for democratic systems in their countries, even though, you know, they may not have experienced them or feel like their governments are not yet democracies. And this includes places like Sudan and Ethiopia and Algeria. And so there are strong demands for democracy on the continent. And this is often led by young people. They've been very active and engaged. They're more connected internationally and know what the governance norms are elsewhere. And they have higher expectations of their governments than previous generations. You know, they're demanding more transparency. They're demanding more accountability. And importantly, they're doing so through nonviolent means. They're trying to protest peacefully to demand their rights and trying to reshape what the expectations are and what the basic civil liberties and political rights would be.
Even though the civilians have protested peacefully, there has been violence in places like you mentioned, Ethiopia and Sudan. Do you think that this summit can actually make a difference in countries like that?
I think the summit makes a difference by elevating the importance of democratic norms and the fact that the international community is going to set standards and try to reinforce those norms through both carrots and sticks. And we have seen that this matters, what expectations the international community has and how they're willing to engage on governance issues will make a difference. And this is especially relevant in Sudan. You know, Sudan has huge levels of debt. It needs large inflows of foreign investment to help stabilize the economy. And so that engagement is going to be very important for Sudan's transition. Now, one summit on its own isn't going to make a difference. It's going to be what happens after the summit and how these norms and how these principles get applied in practice. And, you know, we've seen a growing inclination of African governments and militaries to subvert democratic processes. And so it will be important following the summit that the United States and the international community push back against those sorts of undemocratic maneuvers if this summit's going to have a lasting difference.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Centers for Strategic Studies. He was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam from Washington. Residents of the Ethiopian town of Lalibela, a UN World Heritage Site, say Tigrayan rebels have captured the area from federal forces for a second time. Galmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
Town residents who spoke to Reuters said the rebel force captured Lalibela on Sunday following the exit of Ethiopian troops. The eyewitnesses say that, for no reasons that are known, government soldiers began to leave Lalibela Saturday night and they heard an exchange of fire from a distance. Neither the Ethiopian government nor the Tigray forces have commented on the situation in Lalibela. However, AFP has reported that the TPLF has launched attacks on many towns around Lalibela. TPLF-affiliated media also report an engagement with Ethiopian forces around Gashana area, 59 kilometers from Lalibela. Ethiopian government troops took over Lalibela, home to 11 ancient rock-hewn churches, 2 weeks ago, driving out TPLF forces who had been in control of the town since the beginning of August. The town was freed a week after Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed went into battle to lead the fight against the Tigray rebels. Lalibela Church, a UNESCO-recognized World Heritage Site, is a place of pilgrimage for Ethiopian Orthodox Christians. Recently, government-run outlets reported on preparations to celebrate the upcoming Ethiopian Christmas at the site. Speaking to AFP, residents of the town say the TPLF rebels were tough on residents, but treated the holy site well during their month's stay. The Ethiopian government accuses the TPLF rebels of destroying hospitals and basic infrastructures in areas they occupy. Galmo Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has gone into self-isolation after he tested positive for COVID-19. A statement from the presidency said Ramaphosa, who is described as fully vaccinated, is being treated by military doctors for mild symptoms. The number of COVID-19 daily infections has sharply risen in South Africa, coinciding with the emergence of the Omicron variant that has caused some countries to impose travel bans on South Africa, which first detected the new strain. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
According to a statement from the president's office, Ramaphosa started feeling unwell yesterday after leaving a state memorial service held in honor of President F.W. de Klerk, the last leader during apartheid. The statement also announced that Ramaphosa has gone into immediate isolation in Cape Town, leaving his deputy David Mabuza in charge. The Minister of Social Development, Lindiwe Zulu, also confirmed this development in her address to the media today.
As we all learned yesterday that President Cyril Ramaphosa tested positive for COVID-19 and is receiving the relevant treatment, we pray for him too and all South Africans that they all have a speedy recovery.
Ramaphosa recently returned from a tour of four nations in West Africa. His office says he had PRC tests in all of the countries and on his return home and tested negative. It's believed that Ramaphosa has received only a single dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The first group of ordinary South Africans will qualify for boosters at the end of December. This comes at a time when COVID-19 daily infections have risen sharply in the past few weeks from below 1,000 to around 20,000, amid the spread of extremely contagious Omicron variant that has led some countries to impose travel restrictions on South Africa and other nations in Southern Africa. Some experts are blaming vaccine hesitancy for the new wave of infections, while others say the prohibitive PCR test cost is preventing people from regularly testing, something they say could be leading to the spread. And the Competitions Commission Commissioner, Thembinkosi Bonakele, told a media briefing that the country's two major laboratories have been instructed to reduce testing costs.
South Africa has entered a fourth wave of COVID-19. The PCR COVID-19 tests have become essential in the fight against COVID-19. The PCR tests are required by doctors and various institutions, including for travel purposes.
With Ramaphosa expected soon to address the nation on possible tougher restrictions and imposition of mandatory vaccination due to spiraling daily infections, Nomazwe Dlamini is one of many citizens worried by his infection.
The current variant is spreading in a very rapid rate. So for him to test positive this time might mean a lot of things for us, even stricter restrictions and the mandates that we're waiting to hear. So it doesn't sound good. It's not the right time for him to test positive anyway.
To date, just over 3 million people have tested positive for the coronavirus in South Africa. More than 90,000 people have died. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
An investigation by South Africa's Competition Commission says the country's two biggest private pathology laboratories have made billions of rands in undue profit by overcharging people for COVID-19 tests. The probe has led to the AMFAT and Lancet groups reducing the cost of PCR testing, which scientists consider to be a primary weapon against the spread of coronavirus. Darren Taylor has more.
At the beginning of the pandemic, AMPATH and Lancet charged more than 1,000 rand per test. At the time, that was almost $90. Health activists say the high price deterred many people from getting tested. Partly as a result, they say, COVID-19 spread faster. South Africa's now the hardest hit by the pandemic on the continent, with 3.2 million people infected and more than 90,000 lives lost. According to the activists, it's entirely feasible that unjustifiably high prices charged for testing indirectly led to some deaths. The Competition Commission has forced AMPATH and Lancet to drop the cost per test from the current 850 rands to 500 rands, something that's been welcomed by public health lawyer Safura Abdul Karim.
There's a high reliance on private labs and private testing, particularly for people who are traveling and who need PCR tests for medical reasons. So this is really an incredible victory for public health as well as for broader access to healthcare.
Yet most South Africans still can't afford to pay 500 rands for a test. Tests are indeed free in the public sector, but because those facilities are under immense pressure, results are often only available more than a week later. The Commission's chief economist, James Hodge, says he's satisfied with a pricing agreement reached with AMPATH and Lancet.
As part of our investigative powers, we can and did call for the costing and the financial information for these laboratories, and we did query it, we've interrogated it, and we're comfortable that 500 rand, including VAT, covers the cost and doesn't give them undue profit.
The labs won't disclose how much undue profit they've made on PCR tests, but independent economists say it's tens of millions of dollars, at least. The government's been asking the lab groups to reduce prices for more than a year, so Karim says it's long overdue.
Yes, the two biggest labs are lowering their prices and smaller labs should follow suit. But what we'll also hope to see is a further reduction of the cost of these tests as time goes by. This 500 rand is not an endpoint. It is clearly a compromise to reach a settlement. But if there is evidence of anti-competitive behavior or price fixing, there's no doubt in my mind that there would be room to approach the Competition Commission once more.
Hodge says the commission won't punish the labs.
So there are no fines in this case, and that's almost a product of an accelerated settlement process. So the alternative is we can litigate this, but we could be tied up in litigation for the next year. So there's many uncertainties.
He says the commission had to compromise to get the cost of PCR tests down as fast as possible as South Africa heads into a fourth wave of the pandemic and a period of accelerated testing.
And also we've seen that now increasingly for things like travel and even returns to office, PCR testing is becoming a requirement. So the level of testing that even happens outside of a wave is quite large nowadays. So we want to ensure that the savings are available immediately and we don't delay that for the sake of disimposing a penalty, which would be the only benefit.
Hodges says from now on, Ampath and Lancet Labs will be monitored closely. The groups have declined to speak with the media. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United Nations Children's Fund says about 75,000 people have been displaced in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That includes between 35,000 to 45,000 children living in a remote and inaccessible hilltop camp for displaced people in the Ituri province. The organization says over the past few weeks, the number of displaced people living there has more than doubled, as 20,000 displaced persons were already residing there. Mavis Ochera in Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has the story.
Alista Tinkret, UNICEF's communication officer based in Goma, says children are living in tough conditions on the hilltop in the middle of nowhere, and aid agencies can only gain access to them by helicopter. He described conditions there as hellish, with drains running through the camp, few latrines, and a number of security concerns. Tinkret says access to food and improved water and sanitation and hygiene is a major challenge for inhabitants of the camp. He says it is difficult to determine the exact number of children who have been killed by militants, but there are numerous cases of young people who have been raped or killed with machetes. He says the militants have destroyed and looted a number of schools in the area, and seeking access to hospitals is very difficult. Tinkwest says there is a health center in the camp that is treating between 160 to 170 patients a day, but it's located in a remote area far away from any towns, making it unsafe to transport patients to hospitals. He says aid agencies should be helped to access the camps by road, noting that it is difficult to deliver supplies for so many people by helicopter.
Until road access can be guaranteed or can be made secure, these people, I'm afraid, look likely to be living in fairly desperate conditions. The kind of challenges children are having to put up with, if they venture outside of the camp, there's a danger they'll be attacked by militants. In the camp, there's a danger of cholera, because I mentioned the open drains. The whole camp, I'm afraid, really is in a very, very dangerous and very precarious position, and that's especially dangerous for children.
Tinkwist says it is too dangerous for children to venture down the hillside with jerry cans to collect drinking water from streams and ponds, as they could contract waterborne diseases and risk violence from armed groups. But help is on the way. He says UNICEF hopes to launch a rapid response effort that would provide the camp's inhabitants with needed items, including tents, cooking utensils, and sanitary items. The organization is also lobbying to improve the camp's access to medical facilities and clean water. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Ochery in Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
on the next Straight Talk Africa. We'll review Africa's most important stories and memorable moments of 2021 and the major events that made headlines across the continent and around the world. Was 2021 a year to remember or one we would rather forget? Join me, Haydee Adams, for a look at Africa, the year in review, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 8.